And we continue with this incredible story of things that went on at this remote ranch in Utah with our guests Colm Kelleher and George Knapp. We'll be back with both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. A little bit later on in the program tonight, we're going to chat with George a little bit about Area 51. And I'm then going to open up the phone lines to give you an opportunity to talk with both of them about some of these very strange things right here on Coast to Coast AM. Colm, we were talking about the apparent demonic attacks on this ranch, and my thoughts were that if they were, purely extraterrestrial visitations, I don't think they'd be that evil. So what's going on there?
Yeah, we really looked at a whole bunch of different hypotheses, including the so-called extraterrestrial hypothesis, and we gained the idea that maybe the military was sort of experimenting with exotic technology out there. We were exploring the idea of some kind of a dimensional phenomena. So we had a whole bunch of different, and we also explored, by the way, that the idea that the family had hoaxed everything. We explored the idea that both the family and the researchers on the property were hallucinating, and we ruled that out. In short, we never actually gained enough scientific evidence to really go down the route of the extraterrestrial hypothesis or go down the route of the interdimensional hypothesis. But what we did know was that there was a combination. It was not only dark incidents that were happening on this property. For example, on the very day that the Gormans had finally... They had sold the property, and they were taking the last drive through the property. In broad daylight, they saw the silver disc that came low over the ridge, which was to the north of the property, flew right over the property, stopped, and as they both looked at it, and this was broad daylight, it just vanished in this brilliant sort of brilliant blast of light. And both of them felt the sort of happiness that they had never felt on that property. So, it was not only sort of the dark, demonic kind of stuff that was happening, but there was also stuff that was not immediately sinister. It was not all completely dark.
Maybe they were just relieved, Colm, to get out of there.
They were very, very relieved to get out of there, yeah. But. You know, there were other incidents that were not directly sort of attacking them, but by and large, I think they were feeling threatened, especially by the incidents that George had talked about, which is the day-to-day, low-level poltergeist activity continually happening in their surroundings. And you know, if you put those sort of day-to-day incidents against the backdrop of their economic situation, which is slowly going down the drain because of these spectacular mutilations and disappearance of their cattle, then you add two and two together, and by mid-1996, they really had made the decision to get the hell out of there.
You know, you look at the idea of whether or not it's evil, and we tackle that in the book. Frankly, we don't have enough information to answer it one way or another, and it certainly seems at times evil to us, to humans. The effects were dramatic and terrible on the family. I mean, they were a wreck by the time they finally got out of there. But you know what? We really can't even guess is if that was the intention of whatever was behind this. It had a trickster quality to it, you know, sometimes playful, always interactive, generally kind of clever, always one step ahead of both the family and the NIDS team, as if it was able to anticipate the next move. So we could see it as evil, and the effects, some of them were evil, but whether that was the intention or whatever was behind it, we can't even really surmise.
Well, once the Gorman family moved out then, sold the property, did the NIDS team that came in, including you, Colm, did you start experiencing some horrible things?
Well, it was pretty quick, actually, in August to September of 1996, we moved in an entire sort of command and control center We moved in equipment. We moved in personnel. So the atmosphere on the property changed dramatically within that sort of August-September framework. You know, it was no longer a terrified family living in their, you know, in the single room for protection of their homestead. It was now people out there tramping on the fields, people with equipment out there at 2 and 3 a.m. trying to measure stuff. So within probably a month or two of being on the property, we were there all the time. We had instruments, so we did see some objects in the distance that were behaving unlike any aircraft, any satellite, any helicopter, any flying object that we'd ever seen. There were four witnesses to that first incident. It was distant, and it was certainly not in your face spectacular like the Gormans had been talking about, but it was a beginning. And then a couple of months later, myself and another physicist were outside the command and control center about 1 a.m. on a November night, and this object came in over the ranch. It was completely silent. It was moving at least at the speed of a jet fighter. It's impossible to tell either the altitude or the distance at night, obviously. But this thing came so quickly over the command and control center, did a 180 degrees, and then headed back north very, very quickly. By the time we got cameras to bear on the thing, it was moving right over the ridge, and we got one or two quick photographs of it. But, you know, a distant blur on a photograph is not really good for photographic analysis.
No. Were you convinced, though, Colm, that whatever you saw was physical as opposed to some kind of a dimensional illusion?
We really, at that early stage, and this was very, very early stage, September to November of 1996, those couple of incidents, really, there was no way of telling what they were. I mean, you know, it was they didn't conform to anything we knew about. But, you know, as 1997 began to dawn, and sort of March 1997 came around, and we investigated the daylight dismemberment of a calf on the property within a couple of hundred feet of the command and control center, that was really something that got our attention, because it was the physical mutilation of an 84-pound calf in broad daylight, and the rancher and his wife were only 300 yards away. They were in the same field, having tagged the animal. This calf was completely devoid of internal organs. Its ribs were jutting into the sky. There was not a single drop of blood on the animal, and this all happened in broad daylight with the two people only 300 yards away. They did not see anything. They did not hear anything. The NIDS investigative team, including a veterinarian pathologist, arrived within hours of that incident. We were standing over the animal, did a complete necropsy, videotaped the crime scene, treated it exactly like a crime scene, a forensic, and did the usual forensics. Veterinary pathologist during the necropsy found that a sharp instrument had been used to remove the ear, took samples, sent them to two independent labs, and the labs came up with exactly the same thing. Sharp instruments had been used to dismember that calf in broad daylight with a couple of witnesses 300 yards, you know.
And I'm sure, had there been somebody there doing this, they would have seen him, right?
Well, that was definitely what we took from it. And, you know, immediately as part of the investigation, we engaged a professional tracker who makes a living actually, you know, tracking. That tracker went through the property at a radius of a quarter of a mile around the dead calf and found no tracks to speak
Nothing.
Of that were,
that's
you know,
incredible.
Discernible.
Absolutely staggering. Okay, so when the NIDS group took over the ranch and some of the people started moving in there for testing purposes, what kind of equipment did they bring in? What was the method to start figuring out what was going on there?
Since this was a 480-acre property, you know, we decided that the best way to cover this property was to have portable equipment to be ready at the drop of the hat to go a couple of or a mile or two this way or that way. So We had a variety of electric field, magnetic field detectors, alpha, beta, gamma, X-ray detectors. We had digital camcorders and cameras. We had night vision technology. But we also had a handheld spectrometer, which was hooked up to a laptop. We had a Fresnel lens to collect light through a spectrometer, which would dump in real-time data onto a laptop any analysis of unusual lights on the property. The reason that was important is that for 50 years, people have been trying to obtain spectra, real spectra from the so-called UFO phenomenon, based on the idea that if you know what chemical elements go into making a light, you have at least some idea of what's behind that light. So we had this portable spectrometer that we carried with us in addition to all of this equipment. So it was not the usual sort of investigation that people normally carry out into these phenomena. We were fully funded and fully equipped due to the vision and the largesse of Robert Bigelow.
Sure. What other incidents, George, were out there of the horrible kind?
Well, I'll tell you one that's very disturbing, and it goes back to what I was saying about the trickster quality of this phenomena. Okay. And it dealt with the bulls. The family had these four prized bulls, 2,000 pounds each, very valuable animals. And at this point, the rancher and his wife had already lost a big chunk of their herd. They're driving to town, and they comment to each other almost in an offhand way, man, if we lose one of these bulls, we're in serious trouble. They come back a short time later. All four of the bulls are gone. They're out of the corral. They're gone. They're missing. So they're sort of panicked. They start looking around for the animals. Inside this corral is this metal trailer that's used for storage purposes. There's only one way into it. This door is locked. It's wired with this thick wire. And so the rancher, he can't find the bulls, almost on a whim, peeks up into this tiny little slit at the top of the corral, at the top of the trailer, and looks inside. There are all four of the bulls crammed inside this trailer up against each other, almost as if in a trance. Now, these are powerful animals, surly animals. You'd have a heck of a time getting one of them in, let alone all four of them. He yells to his wife, hey, they're in here. And when he makes that sound, the bulls wake up out of this trance and start kicking the heck out of the sides of this thing. It really goes back to the trickster quality. The animals weren't harmed, but it was clear that something was really messing with their minds. There was an additional incident that that really is disturbing. When Colum and the team were there, where they saw these gigantic eyes perched in the top of this tree. I mean, giant cat-like eyes. And there was some other object, animal on the ground, large bear-type thing, Bigfoot-type thing. The rancher takes off in his truck with his gun. Colum and another scientist were following in another vehicle. The rancher jumps out and point-blank fires at these animals. He's sure that he hit both of them. Something falls out of the tree, though the object, the animal, whatever it was on the ground, basically disappears. At the time, it was winter. There was snow still on the ground, so the team grabs flashlights and starts chasing. And it's a statement to the bravery of the team and the rancher. They start chasing what they think is a large wounded animal. They find a giant footprint in the snow. It's like a raptor. It's this three-toed thing, but Colum can describe it better than I. They never found another footprint, never found any blood, but in essence, it was like a dinosaur in this tree. And that also, like the wolf, was bulletproof. Pretty scary stuff.
Well, Colum, could these have been extraterrestrials? I mean, you know, we've heard the stories of reptilians and things like that. Or do you think it's something else?
Well, the problem with these animals or whatever they were was they had the nasty habit of leaving absolutely the minimum of evidence behind that we could we could go after, and that's why NIDS was really set up was to use the scientific method. And forensic methodology to go after whatever evidence was left. So, you know, we were left with a single footprint in the incident that George just described. Luckily, we had a body from the calf to go after, and we used the best in forensics to establish that, you know, this was not sort of some kind of predator arriving. This was a sharp instruments were used on the calf that was dismembered. You know, and actually, interestingly, the incident that George has just described happened two nights after the dismemberment of that calf, and it happened in very close proximity to where the calf had been taken apart. So we think, or we hypothesize at least, that those two incidents were part of a continuum of, you know, high strangeness on the property. But in terms of, you know, nailing down, okay, was what was happening, quote unquote, extraterrestrial? Was it interdimensional? The kinds of fleeting evidence that were left behind were not able to grab on and to test and eliminate hypotheses given the dearth of evidence from this particular incident.
What's happening to the property today? Who owns it? What's going on there?
NID still owns the property. It's still being under 100% surveillance, 724. There are two personnel on the property who are watching all of the time. They report to NIDS. So it's an ongoing surveillance operation. It is at a much lower level than was happening in 96, 97, and 98. But the research still continues.
Are bizarre things still happening there?
There are sort of peaks and valleys. There are still things happening there, yes.
We should point out that the whole scenario changed when NIDS arrived and took up residence and the family left. I mean, instead of the family being terrorized and hunted, the NIDS team was hunting whatever this thing was, and it seemed to indicate that it didn't like it. There was one very dramatic incident that happened, almost a statement from this phenomena or intelligence, that it didn't like being photographed. NIDS had established a series of wide-ranging video equipment on the top of telephone poles that could cover a great deal of the pasture and the ranch and look for evidence of whatever popped up. Well, something went up one of these poles, ripped out the guts of the video gear, tore out all the wires. Not only did that, but the wires had been attached to the telephone pole with this thick tape that had been baked in the sun. It took all that tape away as well. Well, when this incident occurred, the team immediately realized, hey, we've got other cameras that could focus on this pole. We should be able to back up the tape, figure out the time it happened, and we'll see whatever or whoever did this. When they backed up the tape, they basically saw nothing. Whatever Jeez. Did it was invisible. I think there was some subsequent photo analysis or heightened visual quality column. What did you see?
Well, we brought all of the tapes back to Las Vegas, and this happened at 8:30 at night in the summer, so there was still enough light in order to increase the resolution by digital analysis. When we increased the resolution, we could actually see the tiny red lights underneath the video cameras going off as power was cut from the three cameras. But at the same time, there was no evidence of anything living or otherwise near those cameras as they lost power. Now, the resolution was good enough to see the lights going off. It was not good enough to see the actual wiring being ripped out of the cameras. But we could correlate almost exactly the timestamps on all three video cameras that lost power and correlated with the timestamp on the camera that was watching the three cameras as they lost power, and they both matched exactly. So there was no monkeying around with time in this whole thing. I mean, the simple fact of the matter was that something ripped out the wiring in full view as it was being filmed in full view, and it was not visible on the film.
And the lesson we've sort of derived from that is whatever this thing is or was doesn't like to be photographed, doesn't like to be hunted, and it was making a sort of a definitive statement to that effect. I mean, because that's when things sort of went underground. Whatever it is kind of went into hibernation. The dramatic incidents decreased to the point where NIDS no longer felt it was necessary to have Colum and his colleagues up there 24/7. And so that's where it is now.
And it's obvious that this creature, whatever it may be, this entity, doesn't want anybody around. We'll be back in a moment with Colum Kelleher, George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines for you. We'll be back in a moment. We'll continue talking. I want to get both their take now. They're see what kind of conclusions they've come to about this property, this remote ranch in Utah. We'll also talk with George Knapp about Area 51, get his take on that. You know, he broke some big stories a few years ago. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And those of you just popping in, we're talking with Colm Kelleher and George Knapp about an incredible story at a remote Utah ranch. Strange things occurred there over the years, still do. The National Institute for Discovery Science, NIDS, owns the property now. George and Colm, I'm going to ask you both just to step out a little bit and give us your own conclusions on just what the heck you think has been going on this ranch. Colm, we'll start with you first. What do you think? What's your gut tell you?
Well, my gut tells me that there was something that during 1997, when the NIDS investigators were on the property, every time we were on the property, something was happening, you know, and there's a litany of incidents beginning in March 1997 going all the way through. That's something... did appear to have some kind of an intelligence. And what that intelligence was, I still have no idea. But there was a sense during that six-month period in 1997 when all hell was breaking loose. Every time we were on the property, stuff was happening. We were engaging, chasing these orbs of light around a particular homestead in the middle of the property. Red orbs were attacking cattle. Strange creatures were appearing, disappearing. We had a really spectacular incident with a black humanoid type creature crawling through some kind of a tunnel, visible in infrared, but not visible with the normal cameras. All of that added up to some kind of an intelligent phenomenon. Now, was this a Grand Central Station? Did it happen to be just some kind of a location that attracted a whole bunch of diverse and unrelated phenomena? We have no way of knowing. But we do know that what was ever on this property is potentially intelligent and should be investigated further by science. I mean, one of the reasons that we wrote this book, The Hunt for the Skinwalker, is to begin to ask folks that perhaps this is the kind of stuff that should be looked at by science in the future rather than sticking to the straight and narrow of mainstream science. This kind of phenomena needs to be investigated as a door to opening the discovery process. I mean, after all, it is the discovery of the study of anomalies that does automatically lead to the discovery process. And it can actually catapult the discovery process.
Sure. George, how about you? What about
your
thoughts?
Well, you know, same sort of a theme. I mean, it definitely is an intelligence. It seems capable of manipulating events and matter and minds in ways that we really don't understand. It provides tantalizing hints and tidbits of information about a new understanding of reality. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line of the book without firm conclusions, is that this kind of, it seems to be pointing the way toward some new kind of understanding, maybe leading us down a path to a new understanding of the world around us. Maybe it's that the fact that there are other dimensions, that there are other intelligences, that we're a small part of a very big picture. And it, again, it's worthy of study by people certainly smarter than me. If we can add anything to the larger picture, it's that people need to take this stuff seriously. And I think when the lessons of the ranch and subsequent studies, hopefully subsequent studies, hit us all, it's going to be a mind-numbing, dramatic, fundamental change in the way we view the world around us. And something on the level of the Copernican Revolution, I think it's going to be dramatic.
What do you think it, so I sound like Stephen King here, what do you think it wants?
Well, it could be sort of toying with us, giving us hints, maybe a little bit at a time, not to lead us too fast toward these conclusions. It may have been going on for a long time. The fact that it incorporates UFOs, Bigfoot, poltergeist, cattle mutilations, Indian native lore, things of that sort, almost hints that all of this stuff may be somehow interrelated, that there's a new way to look at this that we just haven't figured out yet.
Did you two ever think about bringing exorcists, psychics, remote viewers, anybody else like that that had this kind of sensitivity to the paranormal on the ranch?
Well, that happened, Colum.
Yes, actually, we employed several different remote viewers at different times to specifically investigate the question you just asked, and we had some uncanny, absolutely uncannily accurate descriptions of the property from people who never visited the property. You know, they were given the usual geographical coordinates, as remote viewers do, and they were asked to visualize what was going on. And one person in particular in 1997 drew the most accurate picture of the ranch I've ever seen, sight unseen, just by the geographical coordinates. Other remote viewers actually explored the property, walked around. NIDS at the time was definitely focused on the scientific method, but we were definitely also open to using whatever armamentarium that the remote viewers could provide us with, to provide leads, to provide new directions for research, to focus on specific locations for employing surveillance cameras or whatever. The bottom line is we were totally open to using remote viewers.
Were there ever any eyewitnesses to touchdowns of craft or anything like this? I know earlier you're talking about seeing three, like almost like burned out areas where the dogs ran into the woods, but any specific hard evidence there?
Well, there were, when we went onto the property, the Gorman family gave us a tour, and there were several locations on the property where these gigantic scoop marks had removed about 200 pounds of soil from the ground, and by the time we got to them, they were a couple of months old. But you could definitely see the indentations, and according to the family, when they first discovered them, it was like this gigantic cookie cutter had just come into the soil and removed 200 pounds. So that was a set of incidents that happened before the NIDS team actually arrived on the property. But while we were on the property, there were no obvious incidents of touchdowns on the property.
There was one very dramatic incident early in the Gormans' tenure on the property. Their first what we would call UFO incident. There was what they thought was an RV. There's only one way to get onto the property. They saw this what looked like a big square-looking recreational vehicle down in one of the pastures. And the rancher said to his son, "Well, somebody got lost. Let's go down there and help them out." And as they're walking toward this thing, its lights are on, what they thought were headlights, and it starts moving toward them kind of slowly. And then as it's moving toward them, it starts rising off the ground and floated over the treetops and out into the sky and out of sight. That was the, I believe, Colum, their first what we would call UFO experience.
Yeah, that's right. And as it took off over the trees, it was perfectly silhouetted against the western sky. The thing looked like basically a large flying refrigerator. I mean, in terms of aerodynamics, where does that come from?
Now, that's pretty big area, 400 plus acres. But were there other reports of UFO landings or anything like that on other neighbors' property?
Oh, yes, definitely. We actually, as part of the investigation, we interviewed all of the neighbors. We interviewed dozens and dozens of people stretching in, miles radius around the property, and we came up with dozens and dozens of different stories of objects landing on the property, close encounters with objects, Mexican hat-shaped UFOs that were seen by the neighbors just down the way, like a few hundred yards from where the command and control center was. So there was a litany of different types of craft that were seen by different people over the previous 10, 20, 30 years in the Uinta Basin, and specifically within a couple of hundred yard radius of the ranch. Multiple eyewitnesses had seen those things.
Well, both of you, great job on the work, Hunt for the Skinwalker. What's been the reaction to the book so far?
Well, I mean, the public is certainly interested. We don't have any sales figures, but it's got a lot of chatter. A lot of people are talking about it. It's doing pretty well on Amazon.com. We've had some distribution problems, at least here in Las Vegas, and a lot of folks saying that they can't get it. A lot of discussion on internet sites and different chat groups, generally favorable. Some people have taken us to task for a couple of things that were beyond our control, one being that we're unable to use the real names of the people involved, at least some of the people involved. Gorman is not the name of the family, and it really boils down to a promise that NIDS made to this family after they'd been terrorized and were completely decimated by their experiences. Colum and his team had promised, hey, we're not going to do anything that's going to draw any more attention to you folks. They've since left the state. They're living somewhere else and trying to start a new life and didn't want this to follow them. So we've kept our promise. And that's bothered some people that we don't reveal the real names. It's bothered some people that we don't have photographs in the book because there were a lot of photographs taken. It's not a real complicated story about why that didn't happen. My experiences on the ranch, I was looking to produce a video documentary. I'm thinking as a TV guy and didn't have still photos. So if we had been able to take the photos that I should have taken during my earlier visits, they would have been in the book. A lot of photos were taken by the NIDS team. They were owned by NIDS, and by the time we got permission to use them, it was too late to get them in the book. But it's no secret what the real names of the family are. They've been published before NIDS got on the scene. It's no secret what the ranch looks like because a lot of photos have been published. So people are kind of nitpicking about it. But honestly, this was an honest effort. The stuff that NIDS did is what science is supposed to do, and they should be applauded for it and not criticized. I mean, scientists are supposed to investigate the unexplained and not explain the uninvestigated. These guys, you know, took this on knowing full well that that they were putting their careers on the line, that it's tough to get a job working in a government lab or a university after you have this kind of a thing on your resume because of the stigma attached to it. But this is what scientists should do.
Is there going to be a TV show here or a program?
Well, I started working on the documentary in 2002 with the permission of Mr. Bigelow. With the help of Colum, we've documented and photographed every inch of the ranch, interviewed a lot of the folks who've seen things, accumulated an incredible amount of info, and yeah, I'm working on a documentary right now.
When might we see it, George?
I would say early March.
Very good. That's not too far away, is it? This year's already going by. Here we go. Well, I'll tell you what, George, let's take the next 5 minutes or so, talk a little bit about Area 51, and then we'll take phone calls next hour with you and Colum. You've got a lot of experience with Area 51, extremely infamous area. What do you, at this point now in your career, and with the years of experience, what do you think has been and is going on there?
Well, I at this point, I would say that there really were some craft out there at one point. Area 51, as you know...
And you're talking about extraterrestrial craft.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, I can't prove it, but, you know, and I'm not just basing this on Bob Lazar's story. He's a controversial figure in ufology, and for better or worse, I'm the guy that unleashed him on the world, but he's not the only source. Over the years, I have more than 24 people who've worked at the base at different times, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, who've all told me bits and pieces of the same story, that they've seen the craft out there, these disc-shaped craft, classic flying saucers, either flying or in hangars and sequestered away, and I believe them. You know, it's not something that we're ever going to be able to prove. I don't think the government's ever going to open the doors and say, here are the flying saucers, come in and kick the tires. But these are people who told me their stories under duress, who were extremely worried about what would happen to them if their identities were revealed. And I got to know some of them pretty well. Many of them were, after they telephoned me and we talked, were visited by government agents who scared the hell out of them and told them to keep their mouths shut. I mean, one right after another. I think something really was going on out there. A lot of folks chalk it up to a disinformation exercise, psychological warfare. Maybe they were trying to, distract attention from something that really was going on. Well, if that was the case, it was a miserable failure because as a result of my stories, I mean, tens of thousands of people have trekked out into the desert to see whatever it is that's flying around out there. Every major news organization in the world has visited the property, even though for a long time they gave me a pretty bad time about it and still do. And I think it was there for a while. Where it is now, I have no idea. There's too much attention on the base, I think, to reasonably think that it's still there.
Do you remember the movie Independence Day?
Sure.
And they took the alien to that Area 51 area. I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of what might have been going on there.
Well, it's pretty close, I think. I remember watching a special premiere of that movie that they had in Las Vegas, and people were watching the part where the Secretary of Defense finally tells the president, yeah, well, there really is an Area 51, and maybe we had aliens out there, and the audience sort of, they all nudge each other. See, it's true, you know, that they needed a movie to convince them that this was really going on. I think it was, and I've taken a lot of grief over it over the years, but so be it.
At this point, do you believe that Bob Lazar indeed was who he says he is?
Well, I do, and I know there are weaknesses in his story, which I've admitted from the beginning. I have a hard time believing that he ever got the degrees that he claimed to have earned, because the paper trail just doesn't prove it. But I lived through a lot of this stuff with Bob. There were people following us around for a long time. They were bugging phones, broke into his house, did a lot of crazy stuff, and I think that he's telling the truth as he knows it. Now, whether or not they messed with his head, well, I think there's a pretty good chance that they did. But I believe that he is telling the truth as he knows it.
George, somewhere along the line, we've got to figure out a way where you can be a correspondent and do some reports for us here on Coast to Coast. I know you're very busy with your television responsibilities, but because you're down in that area that we're very interested in, we got to work something out with you.
Happy to do it. You tell me how.
Okay. Well, let's think about that. I'll powwow with Lisa, and we'll see what we can come up with, because I definitely would like you to be part of Coast to Coast. I mean, you are what we always need here, and that's a good, solid news person with an investigative mind who understands this area. And not a lot of people do, as you well know.
Well, I appreciate that.
Well, column one, we're going to keep you next hour for phone calls along with you, George Knapp. And when you want to call and talk to both of them, you can talk about this ranch in Utah. You can talk with George about Area 51 or anything else. As you know, column Kelleher has also talked about crop formations on this program before. He's done a number of series of work there. Column, anything new in that arena?
As far as I know, the formations are continuing in the United Kingdom. I have not really looked into it for many, many years now, actually. A lot of the work I was really focused on towards the latter end of National Institute for Discovery Science was using forensics to look at the cattle mutilation phenomenon. And I think if the history will look at the National Institute for Discovery Science, I think, kindly, in that it will really sort of roll out the carpet on the forensic applications to the study of cattle mutilation.
All right, well, stick with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll open up the phone lines. Our guests, George Knapp, investigative reporter, award winner, and Colm Kelleher, researcher, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't go away.